Rowe from Greenberg Traurig on behalf of Merrill Lynch Trust Company. I rise to introduce my colleagues, Michelle Stocker from our Fort Lauderdale office.
Welcome.
And Dennis Maloro from our Delaware office.
Nice to have you with us.
With the court's permission, Ms. Stocker will be presenting the argument on behalf of appellees today.
Very well.
Thank you.
Mr. Gaddis, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Justice Ridgely, fellow justices. May it please the court, as the briefing makes clear, I represent the appellant in this matter. I'm going to start my argument a little out of order, or put it this way, not out of order, but not in the order in which I presented it in my briefs. It just seemed logical in briefing to deal with the earlier opinion first, the 2007 decision, rather than the post-trial decision. But I think for this argument and to marshal my time, the appropriate thing for me to do is to go right into what was argument two in my brief, which is attacking the decision of the court following trial. This is an important case. Of course, it's important to my client, who's 89 years old and whose trust portfolio fell from $943,000 in 1999 over the successive 3 years to $356,000 at the end of 2002, while nominally being managed, shall we say, by Merrill Lynch Trust Company. But this decision is also important for Delaware, for trust companies who operate here, for estates attorneys who follow it. The decision has been the subject of trade publications. It has been subject of mention at seminars around the country. I've received calls. Members of the Delaware Trust and Estates Committee have received calls about the Chancery decision and the apparent standard that it sets for professional trustees. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but I would suggest that if there's an affirmance here on evidence as thin as was presented to the court below, against all the refutation that was provided by us, by Campbell, the court will indeed be setting a new low standard. And in the short run, trust companies may appreciate that, but in the long run, it's going to do nothing for them, because estates attorneys will start to wonder whether assets of clients placed in Delaware trusts are indeed protected at all against neglect. Now, if this had been a battle of equals, financial equals, even in that circumstance, on a charge of neglect, it is unlikely to find a smoking gun memo. By definition, we're talking neglect. We're talking leaving something on autopilot. We're talking about ignoring my client's portfolio. And yet the rhetoric employed by the court in several spots in the opinion would seem to suggest that it was our obligation, litigating against a professional trust company, to find a smoking gun memo. I suggest that maybe that works in a fraud case. Maybe that's an appropriate standard for fraud. Maybe that's an appropriate standard for self-dealing or theft. To expect that a trust settlor and beneficiary could somehow unearth an internal memo that would show, let's pull this off or let's do that or invest in our favorite friends, invest the assets in a favored investment. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about neglect. The defense case, I tried to emphasize this, and of course, getting ready for argument, one pores over the prior briefs and thinks of other ways that phrases could be turned and remarks that could have been made. But the defense case consisted of no live testimony whatsoever from anyone who was present on behalf of Merrill Lynch Trust. Not a single one of the many trust officers, and I put that in quotes because they seemed to change with the wind, I guess, as people got promoted internally. Not a single one of those people testified. Barbel O'Hare, the key broker who swung the whole deal, she didn't testify. We were able to take a deposition of Terry Smith, a broker in Rehoboth, but of course his testimony was, immediately upon seeing this trust portfolio, I could see it was out of balance for an octogenarian. So he doesn't help Merrill Lynch Trust in the least. The best he could do for them is to say, well, I'm a regular broker. I don't know about trust investment, sort of getting beaten down into the hole. But his honest testimony was this portfolio, he could see at a glance, was out of balance. So it's there, nor are there documents reflecting deliberations on their part. The defense consisted of a claims investigator with the title of vice president, certainly a pleasant man, but he was basically a claims investigator, and an expert saying that the people within Merrill Lynch Trust Company must have been following standard practices. There's no evidence they didn't. It's fine, and particularly given the constraints of having to pay out 10% and yet keep this CRUT, this permanent trust, alive. Now, I submit that neither a jury in Superior Court nor this court nor Chancery Court would approve that sort of a defense in any other setting.
Well, Mr. Gaddis, yeah. I understand your focus on the facts, and as you know, the Court of Chancery opinion even described the facts as distasteful. But help us see where you're going with the facts in light of the ruling on count one with regard to the statute of limitations, the argument in the cross appeal and count two that may also have statute of limitations problems. At the end of the day, based on these facts, do you want us to reverse the Court of Chancery's ruling dismissing count one for the statute of limitations? And with regard to count two, what exactly do you want us to do based on these facts that you're relating?
I don't know which is the appropriate order to take it, but count one, let me speak to count one of the counterclaim, which was the first argument in my brief. As filed, it was an attack on almost every aspect of the trust instrument. Now, and I cited the deficiencies in the instrument and the non-disclosures that I thought were also significant leading to it. Obviously, it's too late. Talk about unscrambling eggs. It's obviously too late to undo the trust.
But my question is a little more targeted. At the end of the day, the Court of Chancery on count one said the facts are distasteful, but the claim is time barred.
Okay. Two things on that, Your Honor. I am not seeking, if there were a remand, if the count one were reversed, we have no desire to take extensive discovery into the account fees that were charged by Merrill Lynch and all the very paper-intensive documentation. We are trying to get count one overturned really for two reasons. One, the self-help that they employed on attorney's fees, in contrast to the longstanding principles in Delaware case law that a trustee can only expend trust funds for its own, for defenses if it benefits the trust. I believe that's what Bankers Trust versus Duffy, it's been around for a very long time. And it's only the trust instrument that gives them the opportunity to take the fees, and we want those fees put back. But there are other statutes that would mandate putting those fees back anyhow.
Well, I'm getting confused here. I thought the question was, why was the lower court decision wrong with respect to the statute of limitations?
Well, it was wrong because, in my view, the court should have applied a latches analysis. And under a latches analysis, Mary Campbell did not wait too long to attack the trust instrument, to say that this trust instrument, and she was, you know, she was without counsel. They were highly tuned with counsel. They had a committee which passed on a trust and accepted a trust, I guess. More than I guess. I mean, they accepted it. It's viewed as a contract, which had what everybody says is an extraordinary provision, this 10% payout provision for extremely long duration. And under those, there was no reason, there was no sign anywhere until Mr. Langendorfer wrote a letter in 03 saying, well, here's the reason why, you know, we have to be so aggressive on our investments. It's because, you know, with this, and that's sort of buried in his letter, but it's because this high payout percentage, the only way to reach it is with a high equity concentration and still have any chance to have the assets preserved for the successive beneficiaries. Now, we're talking somebody who's unrepresented by counsel, who's in her 70s. The records show at that time, the record shows she tried to get information. She made complaints. She did not sit on her hands. She did not come storming into court when the portfolio dropped. All the things that people are admonished against in a corporate setting, they're told to file 220 actions. You can't just sue on the basis of a stock drop. So here's a woman, unrepresented by counsel, trying to get the facts out of Merrill Lynch Trust. And they finally say that in 03 that the reason that they were doing this is because of the 10% feature in your trust. And the counterclaim was, first the NASD proceedings were filed against what was thought to be the right defendant, the people who had sold the trust to her, you know, who were instrumental in selling the trust. And then the counterclaim was filed here, all within 3 years.
Within 3 years of what?
Within 3 years of Mr. Langendurfer's letter. His letter was in May of 2003, and the NASD filing was in March of 2002, and the counterclaim here was filed in November of 2005.
But your client directly expressed dissatisfaction in 2000 and again in 2002, saying the portfolio was not managed according to the agreement that I signed. Did she not?
I don't know if those were the exact words. She's definitely expressed dissatisfaction. But what I would like to, I don't intend to be evasive about this, but what's more important to me is, and I think to our chances of success, has to do with the second argument, because the court said, I even used the phrase, most importantly, any claims about creation of the trust are time barred, and went from that into saying, you know, there were these constraints on Merrill Lynch Trust. And that's the part that makes it somewhat important for me to attack the dismissal of count one, but it is not imperative to attack count one. The facts remain that Merrill Lynch Trust, in this sort of segmented way, Merrill Lynch Trust was involved in selling a trust that had these extraordinary features of 10%, provided charts, which are in the record, which I cited to, which said a trust could not only pay its charges, but pay out 10% to a beneficiary and grow. And the evidence shows, the closest thing to a smoking gun, that when their charts showed 6, 7, and 8% payouts, but with an assumption of a 10% growth rate, the trust corpus would go down, and the broker writes, rerun this assuming 12% growth, 6% interest growth and 6% income growth, or 6% income growth and 6% capital appreciation. And Merrill Lynch Trust did that. So they created this Bernie Madoff-like document, and they show it to Mary, and it says, well, you can put your assets here, you can take out 10%, and this will grow for your children and or be preserved, slightly grow, and grow for charity. Now, those events took place in 1996, I understand. So you know, while I'm fighting to overturn the trust, really financially, mechanically, all that matters at this point about overturning the trust instrument is the attorney's fee portion. But to say that that's history and we don't consider it, we don't consider Merrill Lynch's role in this, we don't consider that Merrill Lynch should know she was unrepresented, that she wasn't getting any advice, and that from 1997 to 2002, Merrill Lynch Trust Company could, simply because she said, I need a bigger payout. I mean, she's a layman. You know, she doesn't have to exercise a degree of vigilance in this. She turns to a trust company, which by name, by nature, is courting precisely this business, a gray-haired business. And she says, yeah, I want more money. That's about the extent of it. Risk was never mentioned to her. And then at the end of the day, when they blow the portfolio at a 99% equity concentration to say, well, in 96, you were okay with a 10% payout, and in 97, you wanted a bigger payout, I think that's wrong. And I don't think that the evidence of, besides I personally think it's wrong, that's not a cogent legal argument, but the evidence shows that they never acted in any way to ameliorate the situation or explore and ameliorate the situation that they themselves had created. They are when the court went on to analogize them to an outside trust company, you know, besides immediately sticking in my craw, it's absolutely illogical. They created this. They and their allies created this. I'm not saying there's anything wrong about a brokerage house selling allied trust services, but when you sell something like that, and you're denominated the point person, and your name appears on all the brokerage statements and the like, for the trust company to walk away as though there's somebody new in this and to do a quick shuffle is wrong. And that got me off into talking about equitable estoppel, doctrines like that. But maybe none of them precisely fit. But how about if this instrument said, I understand I need high risk and there could be a high concentration of equities. Would that be enough to defend a 99%? So we're talking about a document that's ambiguous, not just the inherent problem created by the 10% payout. But if it just had a high concentration of equities, would that insulate them if they had gone to 99% equity? I suspect not. There would still be a basis to complain. Wait, where's your evidence that you took this into account every year as you ratcheted up the equity percentage? And it was never there. Now the other argument, the light is telling me to sum up, the statute of limitations argument coming back the other way, I just don't think those cases are analogous because essentially, if I forget which of the two decisions it is, I'll find it in a moment. Denosica, DeNorsica, which they mention in their final reply brief, to extend the analogy, it would be as though DeNorsica had filed a lawsuit which said, I was injured in this car accident and you were not, and I'm going to prove it that you were not injured. That would set up the parallel thing. I mean, the parallel analogy. They filed this lawsuit, an accounting. They spent over $70,000 to the point they filed it. It was well crafted. You know, a lot of lawyers poring over it. They made the decision to do it. They took the money from the trust, and that lawsuit is equivalent to saying, "You were not injured by anything we did." And I think on that one, Vice Chancellor Noble was wholly right to say issue was joined, and I don't think the count two can be dismissed on that basis. I have so many more things to say, but hopefully I've got a minute or two left. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Michelle Stocker from Greenberg Traurig on behalf of Merrill Lynch Trust Company. It's a pleasure to be here today before Your Honors. It's my first time in the Supreme Court of Delaware. Let me start by maybe answering the question that you asked counsel sort of in the reverse, the question you asked him as to why Vice Chancellor Noble's decision was wrong. I'm going to tell you why I think his decision was right with respect to that count one. Mrs. Campbell argues that a laches analysis was not applied by the court. However, if you look at the opinion from Vice Chancellor Noble on page 10, it states clearly that a court sitting in equity, and I know Your Honor knows the standard, but a court sitting in equity would borrow the statute of limitations for laches purposes. It says it right in the opinion. The court goes on to also give an analysis based upon limitations and equitable tolling. And I think the decision was accurate for a number of reasons. The counterclaim, if you read it, was premised almost exclusively on allegations relating to misrepresentations or alleged misrepresentations that were made before the CRUT was created in 1996. Her own counterclaim says that these representations occurred March, April, I think August of 1996. That's 10 years before she files a counterclaim. 10 years. Each of these claims emanate from the express terms of the CRUT, a document that was in her possession since August of 1996. Likewise, it's undisputed that Ms. Campbell received the monthly reports for the CRUT beginning in September 1996 and continuing each month thereafter. The monthly reports detail the transactions and holdings in the CRUT and clearly disclosed what was in the CRUT's investment portfolio. It's firmly established that a court of chancery, as a court of equity, when determining whether a claim is time-barred, can and will apply a statute of limitations by analogy. In fact, this court has held in the Whittington case that absent a tolling of the limitations period, a party's failure to file within the analogous period of limitations will be given great weight in deciding whether the claims are barred by laches. In this particular instance, the statute of limitations period that's analogous here is a 3-year time period. and the cause of action accrues at the time of the wrongful act. As I've stated previously, all of the allegations go to the formation of the CRUT, which is, as I've said, 10 years ago. The record in this case is clear that Ms. Campbell sat on her rights, and the Court of Chancery correctly concluded that none of the alleged misrepresentations or the adverse consequences that may have resulted can fairly be characterized as unknowable as late as the fall of 2002. As Your Honor pointed out, she admitted that as early as 2000 she had problems with the CRUT. She didn't even write a letter to Maryland's Trust Company until 2 years later in 2002. And then she didn't file her counterclaim until 2006. And that was a counterclaim to our accounting action. One would wonder, if we never filed an accounting action, would she ever have sued?
At the time of trial, does the record reflect what the value of the trust was?
It did.
And what was that?
I believe that when it first started, it was something like $600,000, somewhere around there, and it went all the way up to $900,000. She enjoyed it during a period of growth.
No, I mean, at the time of trial in this case, what was it down to?
I want to say it was somewhere around $200,000 or $300,000. I don't have the exact figure.
Well, we know at one time it was in the 300s.
Right.
And does the record reflect, as I understand it, the trust wants all of its attorney's fees paid out of the corpus of the trust? Does the record reflect how much that's going to be?
Your Honors, there was basically two parts to the attorney's fees issue, one of which was the fees that were incurred in connection with the injunction action, which we are not disputing that. We've already paid that to Ms. Campbell. The second part of it had to do with the fees that related to our defense in the accounting action.
I understand that.
Which the trust agreement clearly provides.
I understand that also.
Okay.
I'm looking for the number. What are the attorney's fees that are going to be deducted from the $300,000?
That's a good question. That, unfortunately, I don't have the number.
Wasn't there a judgment entered?
Let me see. Because what Vice Chancellor Noble did was say that the attorney's fee should be awarded, and then we had separate briefing on that. Let me see if I can find that for you, Your Honor. Yeah, it wasn't part of what was in their appeal. They really didn't address the issue of the fees.
Well, the reason it's relevant in this case is because our court has held until a judgment has been entered on attorney's fees, the judgment's not final, which would make this an interlocutory appeal, which means that maybe it will have to dismiss the case as an improper interlocutory appeal. But putting that aside, much, if any, money is going to be left of the $300,000? You must know what attorney's fees you've requested.
Your Honor, let me just maybe could clarify a bit. As the case was ongoing, the trust was paying its attorney's fees from the CRUT assets as the case was ongoing. Mrs. Campbell had filed a motion for an injunction, and Vice Chancellor Noble denied that motion and said that because of the trust agreement and the clear language that was in there, the CRUT provided for the trustee to be able to take its attorney's fees in connection with pursuing the accounting action. So those fees were already being taken as the case was progressing.
I see.
And I apologize for not knowing the exact figure, but it just wasn't part of the appeal.
So we don't know.
Right?
So there may not be a need to award attorney's fees per se, but we don't know what's left in the trust today?
I don't, because after the decision came out, we transferred it over to the successor trustee, so I don't know.
And how much money did you transfer to them?
That's a good question. I want to say, probably knows better than I do. I don't want to.
Do you know the answer?
Do you know the amount you recall?
Somewhere in the range of about $130,000.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And fees were already taken out, as you stated.
Yeah, fees were already. I apologize, Your Honor, for not knowing that, but it just wasn't part of what we were appealing, what they were appealing. In any event, getting back to my argument, it's, as I've stated, the Court of Chancery, sitting in a court of equity, can apply a statute of limitations by analogy, which is what they did here. There was a 3-year statute, and there was certainly no indication, no evidence whatsoever, nothing pled that would suggest that equitable tolling would apply, because she had not only copies of the trust document, but she also had all the monthly statements as well that she received on a monthly basis. Despite expressing her dissatisfaction towards the end of 2000, She waited.
And how old was she when she expressed that dissatisfaction?
She was in, I don't know her exact age, but probably in her 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And then she wrote a letter in December of 2002. Certainly, if she had dissatisfaction at 2000, that would have triggered her ability to bring a claim at that point, which she did not do. She didn't even bring the claim in 2002 when she wrote the letter.
Did the Vice Chancellor consider her age in applying the latches analysis?
It's not in his opinion. That certainly was argued by her counsel. His written opinion doesn't state that, but I would argue that he would have considered it because he knew how old she was, and counsel certainly made that argument that, in fact, she was elderly, and that's a factor that should have been taken into account. I think what concerned Vice Chancellor Noble in terms of that count one was that, again, the vast majority of the allegations had to do with the formation of the CRUT, which occurred, as I've said, 10 years before. And to extend, did Your Honor?
Okay.
Oh, and to extend the laches from a three-year, you know, to use laches to extend it from 3 years to 10, I think is what troubled him, you know, because that's a fairly long, by anybody's calculations, extension of a statute of limitations for laches purposes, notwithstanding
But the issue came up again when the court was deciding count two, and I'm just going to call the trust, and Pierce
sure.
to distinguish the entities. But as I understand it, the appellant was trying to characterize the trust and Pierce as operating closely together, and the trust defended on count two by saying, look, this was turned over to us with a 10% payout and a life of 50 years, and we were stuck with the parameters of what we were given, and the only way we could determine to succeed was to put over 90% of this in equities. And what the Vice Chancellor seemed to say is, well, that's true, you did the best you could under the circumstances. My question is there really record support for the finding that Pierce and the trust were so separate and distinct?
Your Honor, there was testimony from the representatives from Merrill Lynch that described the relationship between the various entities. And while they are affiliated, certainly, the trust company is, in fact, a completely separate entity from Merrill Lynch Pierce.
But didn't the experts testify that from the day this started, there seemed to be unanimity, even among the opposing experts, that the likelihood of success was 18% or less?
That's right. Both experts agreed that because of the 10% payout and this being a charitable trust with a number of beneficiaries, not just Ms. Campbell, there was Ms. Campbell, her children, and the charities, I think both experts actually did agree that under that scenario, you needed to have a fairly heavily weighted in equities. Where they disagreed was our expert said there is a legal obligation under the trust agreement to make sure that you are treating all the beneficiaries the same, not just focusing on the lifetime beneficiary, Mrs. Campbell or her husband. But they disagreed in the sense that our expert says you have that legal obligation in the trust agreement and you have that legal obligation as a matter of Delaware law to make sure.
Why was it possible then when there was a change in we'll call the manager for want of a better term, and the portfolio went down from over 90% equities to 60% equities. Why was the trust comfortable doing that? Why wasn't the answer from the trust, we can't change the mix in the portfolio because we would be breaching our fiduciary duty because we can't perform? That was never said. It seems that when the new manager was in place, the recommendation was change the mix. This isn't the right mix. It seems inconsistent to say we have a fiduciary duty to have equities in the 90% range and then be able to switch it to 60% when there's a new manager.
Well, at the time, the trust started out, the first investment strategy was growth and income. It then changed to growth at the request of Mrs. Campbell, and of course they did an analysis of their own as to whether that was appropriate, and changed it basically at her request to growth, which then made it very heavy in equities. She then later came back.
But as I understood the record, it wasn't her call to make.
No,
it was the committee of the trust
right.
that deferred to her request, and they could only concur in her request
right.
if they thought it was consistent with their fiduciary duties and their obligation to realize a 10% payout and maintain the corpus for 50 years.
Well, what I can tell you is at the time that they did the analysis as to whether to change it, each time they did change it, there was an audit committee involved. There was a senior trust officer involved. They took into account the considerations of Mrs. Campbell and what she wanted, but obviously that wasn't the determinative factor. It was just one factor that they considered. And when they did the analysis to change it to back to growth and income as opposed to just growth, that was done on a based upon a detailed analysis of the facts that existed at that time in terms of what was in the portfolio, how the market was doing, what the returns were at that time. I think one of the key issues for this case is that Mrs. Campbell would like to view this case with the benefit of hindsight, whereas our expert, and I think Vice Chancellor Noble picked up on this, was viewing this at the time that the facts were occurring.
No, I understand that. But my question is a little more straightforward. The 10% payout and the 50% and the 50-year life were constant. They didn't change. My question for you is, to the extent the loss was sustained by maintaining a 90% mix of equities, why was it permissible to switch to 60% equities if the 10% payout and the 50-year length never changed?
Because at the time that they made the change, based upon the analysis at that time, they still felt as though they could meet the 10% payout and maintain the trust corpus over the time, over the life of the CRUT. Based upon the evidence and the information that was available at that time in terms of their analysis of the market and the market conditions that were occurring at that time, it was appropriate because they could still meet the payout and could still try at least to maintain the trust corpus over the life. So it was based upon information that they did at that time. It was just a review, and they felt that they could meet it. Did that sufficiently answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Well, let me turn sort of to the next issue. You know, we've kind of talked a lot about the counterclaim and whether or not it was appropriate to dismiss that first count. Let me focus now on sort of the second issue on appeal, which Your Honor has already asked me a few questions about. As is, you know, everyone in, I think in this courtroom perhaps is well aware that, you know, this is a abuse of discretion standard. And after 2 days of fact testimony and expert witness testimony, and I do think that this is a case that really hinged a lot on the expert witnesses. We believe that Court of Chancery, Vice Chancellor Noble's finding that MLTC comported with its contractual and fiduciary obligations, it was appropriate based upon that analysis of the witnesses and based upon his analysis of the experts, which in large part agreed on most of these issues. Where they disagreed was whether or not, in fact, you should even try. I think her expert characterized it as an impossible dream, whereas our expert characterized it as not an impossible dream. It was a legal obligation that they had to meet as a result of the trust document itself, as well as the standard of for fiduciaries under Delaware law. And based upon all the evidence...
Well, can I stop you just on that?
Sure.
Are you saying that a 10% payout a year over 50 years was something that could be achieved under any normal circumstances?
You know, Your Honor, it could be. Certainly anything is possible. I think what their expert was saying, that the likelihood was so slim that you shouldn't even try.
And I'm saying, what was the evidence that it had, you know, a reasonable probability, 50% likelihood of being able to be achieved?
Well, both experts relied upon the Bernstein report, which is part of the record in this case, and it's probably the best indication of what could and can may or may not happen relative to a CRUT. And based upon the Bernstein report and what was there, the probability of if you had a mix of portfolio that was more bonds and less equities was something like less than 2%, versus if you had all equities, which is what they did, or a vast majority of equities, all of a sudden those probabilities increased to probably closer to 6%. So there is evidence-based.
So you're saying that if everything had gone normally, if there hadn't been, you know, major fluctuations in the market or whatever, this objective had a 6% chance of being successful?
Let me just quote it exactly. The Sanford report details and concludes that there's an 18% probability of maintaining original value of trust where there is a required, I'm sorry, 18 is not 6, where there is a required 10% payout. The trust is 30 years out and 100% of its investments are in equity. That probability drops to 6% when 65% of the investments are in equity and further drops to less than 2% with a 50% equity investment. So it's actually not 6. It's actually higher. It's actually 18% if you invest it the way that Merrill Lynch Trust Company did. If you had invested it the way that their expert would have suggested, it would have been less than 2%. And even he admitted that his hypothetical portfolio would not have met the 10% payout and would not have guaranteed that the life of the trust.
So would it be fair to sum up and say that this trust arrangement with its objectives was pretty much doomed from the get-go?
I wouldn't say that it was doomed from the get-go, Your Honor. It certainly was difficult and challenging, but certainly not impossible. I mean, there were...
Well, you know, where do you draw the line in terms of allowing, if not encouraging, a prospective client to believe that this is a valid, reasonable investment? Everybody knows that there are risks associated with any investment, but if you're telling me that in the best of all worlds there was only an 18% chance of success here, and if you made it a little bit safer, your chances of success went down to 2%, how do you call that a reasonable investment to recommend or even to allow a client to undertake?
Well, Your Honor, the formation of the CRUT and all of those issues that were dealt with by Ms. O'Hare and Marilyn Shapiro, that was the subject of a separate proceeding in the arbitration. What our argument is and what our argument at trial was, when Merrill Lynch Trust Company took this over as the trustee, they were faced with the reality of a 10% payout and a beneficiaries of Mrs. Campbell, her children, and the charities. They had no choice but to follow their guidelines under the trust agreement and to follow the standard under fiduciary laws in Delaware.
Don't trustees have an obligation to seek a reformation of the trust agreement if they can determine that it is failing in its objective?
Your Honor, under my understanding of a charitable trust like this, is not something that can be broken once put in place. And certainly during the time period when the CRUT was performing well, Mrs. Campbell never complained and enjoyed that. It seems to me that you can't pick and choose between, well, the CRUT is a good vehicle when you're performing and getting a lot of money versus the CRUT is a bad vehicle when the stock market is declining. I think my time is up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I hope I don't talk too rapidly, but there's a lot I do want to say at this point. First of all, in response to the question by Your Honor, Justice Holland, Exhibit CX50, which is at A23, is a listing of the fees taken out of the CRUT, unilaterally taken out of the CRUT by Merrill Lynch Trust, shows the amount of the bills, has a little timeline beside it, and then the running total. I don't have my exhibits with me, but I have noted that that's in the fees, I believe, were taken were well over $200,000 from a CRUT, which going into this whole mess, into this litigation, was in the range of $300. Analogies to having to burn a village to save it came to mind. Ms. Stocker continually says that all the allegations in the case really go back to formation of the CRUT, and so when the door is closed in 1996, or she would have it 1999, you can't even talk about it. Well, that's not the case, and that's a point I've been continuing to make, even or trying to make, haven't made it successfully below, but as some of Your Honor's questioning picked up, even within the constraints
of a 10% payout. There were choices to be made by a professional trustee. The expert, Mr. Culbertson, says it's still worth trying, and, like, he's the expert on the law and what Delaware standard should be. But I think the standard is stated in the restatement of trust. I put it in my brief at page 22, where it says the commentary of the on the restatement said, even with best efforts and prudent conduct by a trustee, however, the combination of objectives with respect to income and principal might not be accomplished. And trade-offs inevitably exist in these matters, and this is so, especially in periods of serious inflation or declining markets. There is no indication that Merrill Lynch gave any attention to it. I would add to Your Honor's observation, this is just all after-the-fact argument by a claimsman and a paid expert whose only engagements had been six or seven cases working for Merrill Lynch. I would, since he retired from PNC, he was not a Merrill Lynch employee. But as Your Honor pointed to the fact that when the new guy finally got through, the new spokesperson, you know, through the Rehoboth office, they adjusted it down. I also would point to the fact that when they began, the original mix was 60% equity. So on its face, prima facie, one does not need 99% equity or over 90% equity when you're managing a trust calling for a 10% payout. I mean, what you do, you know, clearly it was 60, 35, and 5 was deemed to be fine in the original going. Now, Ms. Stocker said, and each time they changed it, there was a senior trust officer involved and the trust committee involved, and it was based on a detailed analysis. I hoped to get through at trial. And I hope to get through in my briefs to this court that there's no evidence of any of that. There was one change in 1997 generated by Ms. Campbell saying, I want more money, and another change generated when someone finally was able to get through to them in 2002. There was no annual review, and those changes don't have any documentation that there was trade-offs and considerations. The only memo in 2002 says the interests of the client. So we're back in a sales mode.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and adjourn. Thank you.